Hey guys, in this podcast, we talk about different health topics. As we are not qualified experts, we would ask for you to check with your doctor first before trying any of the things that we suggest in this podcast. In addition, we talk about third-party opinions in this podcast. Please know that we have no intention of misconstruing or misrepresenting their opinions, and we apologize in advance if we do so. Thanks. All right, and welcome back to another Contemplation Hypothesization podcast. With me, I got Paul.
Hi guys, what's up?
We're going to be talking about improving skill sets today. Paul, you want to start us off on this?
Yeah, so we're just going to jump right into it. Improving skill sets is a lot about psychology, and so it's going to be somewhat similar to our last podcast. So I want to start today by going over George Leonard's three different personality types of learners. George Leonard wrote a book called Mastery, which I highly recommend to anyone listening to this, and in that he came up with three different types of personalities that are really common among people who learn a skill set. The first one's a hacker, and the hacker tends to practice something a lot at once until he gets to a certain skill level.
Okay.
And then he quits. So what he tends to do is like on and off practice, but once he gets to a certain skill level, he quits. Like normally when he hits a plateau, that's when he stops.
Gotcha.
Okay. A dabbler is similar.
Well, sorry to interrupt, but the hacker's probably like my video game skill level, right? Like you play a video game, then you just kind of give up after a while.
And that's a common sort of personality type that's related to learning. A dabbler is very similar. The dabbler kind of dabbles in something just a little bit. Unlike the hacker, they maybe don't spend as much time to get to a certain skill level or plateau. The dabbler just kind of does something on and off. That's probably the most common personality type for a learner, is someone who just kind of jumps in, does it for a little bit, and every once in a while they pick it up. The hacker is more serious about it, but he'll stop as soon as he reaches a plateau.
Okay, what's the third type?
The third type is a little bit more rare, but is also very happens commonly, and that is the obsessive. And the obsessive kind of gets really obsessed about something, and it's the only thing on their mind. But again, like once they reach a plateau, they tend to stop. So they get really obsessed with one thing, and they get really obsessed with another thing, and it kind of moves forward. But what all of these personality types fail to reach is like a mastery of the thing. Each one of them has flaws, often cognitive, that prevent them from reaching like a mastery level at something. And so in George Leonard's book, he talks about like what sort of cognitive errors you have to get over to actually master something, and how you have to view the learning process.
Gotcha. Okay. So what's the difference between a hacker and the obsessive? The obsessive is just more like full-on assault of getting this...
The obsessive, like, the only thing they think about is getting better at this thing. But they kind of only do this in blocks at a time. They don't...
Right.
They eventually stop. Maybe for 2 months, all they think about is that thing. And they're too into it. And what ends up happening is they get good at it, and then they stop, and they go
gotcha.
On.
So what's the strategy for actually getting a good skill set, right?
So the obsessive, one of the problems he has is he just does too much at once. There's a really good book called From... Good to Better to Best, and it's about different companies that have been analyzed over the years and what makes a company the best in the world. Like they studied like hundreds of companies, and they found like 10 companies that fit a really tight criteria for success, and they asked like what was it that these companies had that other companies didn't have, and the big thing that it was they use this term like the 28-mile march. Like every day you march a mile. You don't march 14 miles at once, then 6 the next day, and then 3, then 2, and then 1. Companies that spent too much time working on one area, too much effort, often ended up failing. The companies that made it into this like really tight criteria were companies that kind of did this 28-mile march. Like it was 1 mile a day for 28 days, and this happened year upon year, just little progress day upon day.
So let's say you're trying to learn how to play the violin, just to take an example.
Yeah.
You want to master this skill set. You're saying that it's best to do 1 hour a day and not like 8 hours full on for 2 weeks,
right?
Or something like that.
Yeah.
So, or maybe even 30 minutes a day, something reasonable that you can sustain for a very long time.
Yeah, exactly. And so actually this kind of gets us into another topic, and that's the 10,000 hour thing, 10,000 hours of deliberate practice. And what to get 10,000 hours of deliberate practice in 10 years, it's 3 hours a day. And what they found is that the top performers tend to practice their craft 3 hours a day. So maybe not an hour, like a half hour, an hour is more ideal than doing 8 hours and then giving up, which is what the obsessive does. The obsessive spends too much time on the thing and then runs out of energy and never gets bored of it. And the top performers, like the best violinists, the best athletes, they tend to spend 3 hours a day. And those 3 hours are spent doing something called deliberate practice. So let me just, before I go on to talk more about this, let me just tie that back into the dabbler, the hacker, and the obsessive. So the top performers that they've studied spend 3 hours a day, and they do this over a period of about 10, 20 years before they reach the mastery level, the top of their craft. And this is something that they've observed almost among every top performer. So the problem that the obsessive has, of course, is that instead of spending the 3 hours a day, which they should, when they get really obsessed and they maybe spend 8, 9, 10 hours a day, but it only lasts for a short period of time. Now, I want to also clarify that probably the top performers spend more than 3 hours a day practicing. But what the 10,000 hours is saying is that they spend 10,000 hours of deliberate practice.
Right. And that 10,000 hour rule comes from Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers
book, yeah.
Which we'd highly recommend.
Yeah, that's a great book. Everyone should read it. And so just to try and distinguish what deliberate practice is, and why 3 hours is pretty much the maximum what people do. Deliberate practice is when you use like all of your brain power to practice. Like when you're working on something, you're analyzing it, you're working on improving it, you're using a lot of your brain power instead of just kind of subconsciously running through the motions. So kind of a quick example for like, let's imagine you're playing basketball. A top performer doesn't necessarily play like scrimmages of 3 hours a day, because a scrimmage is ultimately sort of your subconscious skill set just you playing. 3 hours of deliberate practice would be more like practicing left-hand dribble for 3 hours. Let's say your left-hand dribble is weak, or practicing your left-hand layup. Practicing things that you're not necessarily good at, or watching tapes, figuring out what you're not good at, and then practicing those. So a lot of what deliberate practice is working on weaknesses and really specifying which area you want
to
work on.
I think, too, for deliberate practice, that tends to be harder to do.
Right,
you have to have more discipline to do it.
And that's a great point. And that's why 3 hours tends to be the maximum that people spend, because our brains just don't have, brains and bodies just don't have the energy to do that deliberate practice all day. Deliberate practice is much more difficult and it's much more boring. You want to go out there and, you know, do what your favorite thing is. But a top performer goes out and practices what they're bad at.
Let me ask you, so you say 3 hours a day. Is that a continuous 3 hours? Is it better if you break it up, an hour and a half here and there? Or what's the best way
I think that in Gladwell's book, The Outliers, he talks about how people do it both ways. Mm. People wake up, you know, maybe they do 2 hours in the morning and then an hour later on. A lot of top performers practice more than 3 hours a day. Like Tiger Woods is said to practice maybe like 8 to 12 hours a day when you throw in working out and things like that. But they're saying that the core of the practice that really improves the person are this 3 hours deliberate practice. And that is what is making them a great athlete, not the other practice. Most of that practice just kind of rehashes developed skill sets you already have.
Already traded. Another thing I just kind of wanted to comment on, I've said this, I think, before in another podcast, but your sleep also dramatically improves your ability to do a certain skill. So in other words, if you're the obsessive person and you work for, let's say, a month, so 5 times 4, that's 20 days, and you work 8 hours a day, so 8 times 20 is 160 hours total. Versus if you split that 160 hours, let me round it down, 150, 150 hours, and you do that three hours per day, then you can last much longer than just 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Right? You would last 50 hours total, which would be, 2 months in a week. Mm-hmm. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is that you have almost quadruple the amount of nights of sleep with you practicing and replaying what you have done, which means your sleep inadvertently gives you a more competitive skill set advantage.
Yeah.
Compared to the obsessive mastery of a skill level.
Yeah, I don't know if you spoke about this in another podcast, but you mentioned how sleep can help you improve a skill set. If any of the listeners have played Tetris before, then you've probably had dreams of Tetris. And what happens is that your brain, when you're working on developing a skill set, sort of runs these dreams over in your head to help you master the skill set faster. Oftentimes, if you're really struggling with something and you're practicing it all day, you won't be able to do it until you wake up in the morning after night's sleep, because during your dreams, you actually repeat that task over and over until you've reached like a better level at it.
Right.
It's fascinating.
And that's not just coordination, that's also mental tasks as well. Mm-hmm. So anything like from memorization to solving different math problems to figuring out like different algorithms, these are all mental tasks that dramatically improve when you sleep on them.
We talked about the obsessive, we talked about them a lot, and the problem that they have is that it's really hard for people to keep up a ridiculous pace of work for a long period of time. The problems that the obsessives have is that they burn out too fast. They give up. And that is what Gladwell calls them the obsessive, because they give up after a short period of time. So a hacker, someone who wants to get to a certain skill level but then quits once they reach the plateau, they may have sort of a mastery type working schedule where they are working 3 hours a day. But what phases them isn't so much the overworking as much as it is
The plateauing.
And plateauing is a really interesting area. So before we go into more about the hacker, let me just explain plateauing. So when people think about learning a skill, often what we think of is sort of a linear progression,
right?
Like a straight line of improvement. The more hours we practice, the better we get. And a lot of games, like video games, I think perpetuate that. You know, you get experience points and want more and more experience points every time you play, and then you go up a level. But that's just not the case with the human brain, because when you're working on developing a skill, the brain has to wire itself to do that, and it takes a long time for it to wire. But once it wires, it clicks, and you're able to do it. So what ends up happening is more, a picture, a graph, is more like a staircase, where you have these bursts where you get a lot better, and then you have long periods of not getting better, and then you have another burst where you get really better, and then a long plateau.
And each burst correlates with the neurons aligning for that task.
For that task, exactly. And so when people think of sort of the linear type learning, it can throw them off because that's not the way they learn. And so they give up once they stop making progress. They think like, wow, I spent like 5 hours last night practicing. I'm not any better. And so that's where the hacker gives up. Is he reaches a plateau, but he expects to keep getting better from working. What he doesn't realize is those 5 hours of practice were actually doing something, and he just needs more hours until the brain neurons align, and all of a sudden he has a shoot in his ability to perform that skill.
Yeah, let me just comment one thing on that. So a lot of people don't really understand. They're like, okay, so the neurons have to align. What does that really mean?
Mm-hmm.
What this means is that, like, if you compare the brain to a computer has hardware and it has software, like ones and zeros, and you can make your computer better by either improving the hardware or the software, or you can improve both at the same time. But the brain is a little bit different. The hardware is the software, and the software is the hardware. The way the neurons are arranged are the software is the software code, and the neurons themselves are the hardware as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to change your entire hardware infrastructure and software infrastructure at the same time, which
right.
is why it takes so long to align
right.
the neurons to get it to have this burst. That's why it's not linear.
And also what you're going to see in the brain is that when you start practicing, there's a certain area linked to that skill set that you're practicing. And what you'll start out with is just like a couple neuron chains, and it gets thicker and thicker. And like when you examine like a professional athlete and you examine that area of their brain, you see a much thicker, denser area of brain
right.
from all the neurons
right.
growing up.
Yeah, so if you have someone who started playing sports just when they were young in general, they'll have more of their brain dedicated to coordination, like their cerebellum, which is part of the brain, will be much bigger, and they'll have more neurons dedicated to that task. So when they have to pick up tennis, they do it much more quickly than someone who's been playing violin their whole
right.
life.
And that's where you get the idea of like a natural athlete. Well, you don't, I mean, most of these skill sets that people have are not genetic. You know, obviously genetics plays a big part in athletics because your height matters, your speed, your size, your weight, things like that matter. But the actual skill sets are very much environmental, because the kid who's a natural athlete oftentimes has just spent more time doing a repetitive task and building up that area of his brain. And that's why when he picks up a tennis racket, like you're saying, he's better than people who, you know, don't have those other experiences. These areas of the brain that relate to one skill set often
transfer
into another skill set.
Right.
So back to the hacker and the plateaus is the hacker tends to give up at plateaus, firstly because he has this illusion that he will get better with practice, which in some cases is true. But when you practice, like if you really want to reach mastery, you have to learn to love the plateaus. Michael Jordan talks about it all the time, and he's actually talked a lot about mastery. But he's spoken about how, you know, you keep putting in the hours and you keep practicing and you don't always see improvements. The better you get, the longer the plateaus become.
Right.
And that's actually why you have something called the J curve. So if you picture a linear graph where you have time on the bottom and then you have skill level on the top, the linear graph, you know, is a straight line to an angle. You see, like, as time goes, skill gets better. Now, what the learning process is really like when you begin is like a J curve. And what happens oftentimes when you learn a new skill set and you start implementing it, let's say you play like a video game like Super Smash Brothers and you want to teach yourself, you know, how to wave dash. When you start implementing that wave dash into your play, you suddenly get worse.
So you're at the bottom of the J.
So as time goes, you get worse at the skill set.
Yeah.
That's what happens often when you're learning something new.
Yeah.
Because you have to sort of...
Or dribbling with your left hand.
Dribbling with your left hand instead of your right hand. You suddenly become a worse basketball player. But what happens... The J curve is awesome because when you start seeing your skills go down,
you know
they're coming, they're going to get a lot better really fast.
Right.
And that's a great thing that people need to remember when they're learning a skill set, is often not getting better or sucking at something is a sign that you are going to get a lot better if you just stick with it for a little bit longer.
Right. And that J, the upper exponential part of the J can correlate to the burst that we
the burst,
were just
exactly,
about.
Yeah. Once it clicks in your brain just a little bit, then you're suddenly going to be a much better player. So what you see great athletes doing is like they have a weakness and they go through these J curves all over the time. And what you see with athletes who aren't as successful is that they stick with what works and they just play that way. They're really conservative. A great athlete works on their weaknesses and they go through this J curve process, which makes their entire skill set much better over time.
Yeah, and this is actually why humility is such a big factor. Like in sports or competitive skills, you always want to be the best.
Mm-hmm.
But the person that is humble enough to experience the J curve and let
right.
other people beat them actually end up winning in the end.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point, actually. One of the things I worked on an ebook on becoming better at first person shooters, and one of the things I start with is that when you're learning a skill set, your focus should be on becoming good, not being good. When you are trying to be good, your ego is very involved. When you lose, you say like, oh, you know, you make up excuses and things and stuff. But when you're focused on being good, you take those losses and you say like, this means that I'm going to get better. I can improve this area, and this area. But as people, the common tendency is to be concerned about being good at
right.
the time. So let's take Super Smash Brothers again. Let's say you play a friend who's better than you, and you're concerned about being good. When you lose, you're like, oh, like my controller messed up.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Oh, it wasn't fair. You make up all these excuses because you expect yourself to be good then, and you don't see this future self that you come into being. But when you think about becoming good, you focus on what you can do to become better, and that's what you'll see among great athletes in general, is that they do have that. And so that's how psychology can really affect how you learn. And the humility is a big part too. Being able to see weaknesses in yourself and accept them and then move forward. Because most people are bad at something and they don't take the time to recognize it and then work on it.
Yeah, I think one thing we should also talk about too is in the moment, especially for maybe when if you're in a first person shooter and you're all on your last life, mm-hmm. or you're in a basketball game and it's the last 30 seconds of the game and it's tied score. These are all moments where you're under an extreme amount of pressure. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that is mentality. You'll see people just either make completely devastating mistakes, like very basically, what are you doing? This is the last 30 seconds. Or you'll see them just rocket excel. And I think, honestly, it's totally a psychological game, especially with tennis, too. This happens all the time.
Yeah.
Momentum is another thing we can talk about as well.
Momentum, it's huge.
But it's clearly all psychological. There's mm-hmm. no physical... the psychology manifests itself into physical or physiological effects.
Mm-hmm.
But what is it on those last 30 seconds of the game
that makes someone
so good? What are they thinking?
So, like, one of the things I like to think of this a lot, a perfect example is golf. You have Tiger Woods and then you have the rest of the field, and when Tiger Woods is on his game, everyone is facing Tiger Woods, and what you see in the fourth round on the final day is that you'll have other people maybe up there with Tiger Woods, but then they play with him and they succumb to the pressure, but he gets better and he beats them to the ground. And so you have these athletes, Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods, Muhammad Ali, who became better with pressure. And I think that a lot of it has to do with their mentality about pressure to begin with. Tiger Woods is a person I often go to when I'm talking because he's very big on getting better. Like when you listen to his press conferences, he's always like, I'm improving. He never admits that he's good. He's always like, I can be better. I can do this better. I can do that better. Like, you know, pieces of my game came together, but this area is still weak. He's always looking for what he can do better. And I think the big mentality is when he gets in those final rounds, he loves the pressure. He has learned to love the pressure.
So what is he thinking in his mind? What is he saying when it's like the very, you know, very last hole? Like, what is he saying?
Well, what I think that he's doing, which I think is very smart, is he is entirely focused on what he's doing. He's not thinking about the consequences.
Yeah, this could be the first hole or the last hole. It doesn't matter. I know is I just want to get the ball in the hole.
Right, and, you know, I'm sure that he's affected by the pressure. And one thing he does is he plays his best probable move. You know, he doesn't try a ridiculous shot when it's coming down to the wire. He does what he's most comfortable doing. Michael Jordan once said in an interview when he was asked, what do you think about before a game to prepare? And he said, I don't think about the game, because the only thing that comes from thinking about the game is thinking about how you'll mess up.
Right.
He's like, I focus on practicing while I'm practicing, and when I'm playing, I'm focused on the game. So when Tiger Woods comes down to that last hole, he's focused on where he's going to put the ball on the fairway, what type of swing he's going to hit, and he doesn't do anything different. His father said that when he taught Tiger Woods at a young age, people would always ask, like, how do you train Tiger to, like, never hit the ball in the water? Because it's rare for Tiger to, like, succumb to pressure and, like, hit a terrible shot in the water. And he said, I just always taught Tiger to tell me exactly what he was going to do on that hole and to not even look at the water. If there's water on the hole, don't even look at it. Just tell me what you're going to do. And so I think when he comes to the hole, he says, I'm hitting it there. I'm using this club, this stuff. And he doesn't even look at what could go wrong. And I think that good athletes practice this ability over time. They give themselves challenging situations, and they practice focusing on the tasks that they have to do. And then on top of that, you have, from those actions, you have the zone, and when your brain actually fully is in use when performing a sport.
Yeah, so as you guys all know, when you're under pressure, the fight or flight response kicks in, you get adrenaline, your pupils widen so you can see more. There's all these other effects, like your intestines don't work as well because you don't need those at the same time. There's all these effects that your body does to enhance your ability to physically perform or mm-hmm. mentally perform, giving whatever the task is. But I think, despite that, what can happen is momentum can shift your fight or flight response. So if you're in a game, a tennis game, you're up like maybe three sets, and then all of a sudden, just out of nowhere, this guy is just like making this huge comeback. And it's 3-3 now, but he has the momentum still. So it really feels like it's 5-3 or 4-3, but it's not. It's still 3-3. And he uses that momentum to surpass you. It's psychological momentum. And I think in that case, what you were saying earlier, the best strategy is just to say, you know what? This is just a tennis match like any other tennis match.
Yeah.
This is just like I'm normal on the courts with my friend, not even keeping track of score. This is the same thing. I'm just going to swing this forehand, this backhand, just like normal.
So Philip Jackson was the Lakers and Chicago Bulls coach, and he's responsible for a lot of wins. And what was really common, or what people said about him, is that he really preached sort of the Eastern philosophy ideas. And Tiger Woods, his mother was from the East, and he visited China at one point and visited a Buddhist monk, and he even has a bracelet that the Buddhist monk gave him. And Michael Jordan talks about a lot of Eastern philosophy ideas. And I think that those ideas are what shapes great athletes. And so let me talk briefly about those. One idea that I think is really important to an athlete or anyone performing is the idea of outcome dependence. Now, what outcome dependence is not being dependent on an outcome, but being dependent on what you have control over. Okay. So let's say you're in the at the end of a basketball game. You can't be dependent on your team winning. Because that you're just wasting energy. It's not helping you at all. And it's making you nervous and you're thinking about what could go wrong. But what you should be dependent on is everything that you have control over. You have control over how much energy you're going to put in, how much focus you're going to put in, especially in golf. You have control about where you're planning to put the ball, how much attention you're going to put into that shot, and how much energy and stuff like that. So as a player, you have to learn to become outcome dependent. And you focus on what you have control over, and whatever happens, happens. You did everything under your control. And so that's sort of the mindset you need to have when you play a sport, is that you control what you control, and if it's, you still lose, there's nothing you could have done to change it, and so you must accept it. The problem with being dependent on outcomes is that you don't have control over outcomes.
Right.
And you end up just, you know, pushing yourself down, and ultimately becoming more stressed. The reason why outcome dependent works is because it takes stress off you. You think, like, I don't need to worry about the outcome, I just need to worry on what I have control over.
So this completely shifts the paradigm from, I play to win, to, well, I'm just playing to do my best.
Right, yeah, and the whole play to win thing, I think, is like overrated. Like, when you study people like Michael Jordan and Tiger Woods, of course they play to win, but they win by playing their best game. Tiger Woods, like, says, like, he doesn't even like want to look at the other people's scores. He wins by beating the golf course, not by beating his opponents.
You know, one thing I gotta comment on just as a parallel is in, like, college, you know, it gets really competitive and everyone's trying to get better grades than the other person, and always this situation always arises where people are like, what's that person's GPA? What did he get on that exam?
Mm-hmm.
And I had a friend I grew up with, and he never looked at anybody else's score.
Yeah.
And he normally, like, did the best. Mm-hmm. Out of, I mean, not maybe number one, but he was, you know, phenomenal still.
Yeah.
And he never stressed out because he just said, you know, I'm going to be here to just do my best, and that's it.
Yeah.
And
this is so important, actually. Like, it's hard to conceive necessarily how important it is, but what happens when you base what you do on other people is that you become incredibly stressed. You know, ultimately, a lot of the stress is built up from having unrealistic expectations. Let's say you're like, this is what happens to the dabbler, is that he starts playing something and he's not good because he thinks he's not good because he compares himself to his friends or people who are better than him, and he says, I'm not good, so I'm just gonna give up.
Right.
But the way you have to look at it is, you have to say, like, just look at your own progress. Like, I got better today, I should feel good about myself. Like, and so what it changes your entire perspective when you have a game and how you feel about it afterwards, because if you feel terrible about your game because you're comparing yourself to someone who's better than you, then you're gonna, like, not have the motivation necessarily to work hard. I think that a lot of top athletes think very positively about good things that they do. When Tiger Woods has a good day, he says, you know, I've had a good day. Even if he's losing the tournament, he's like, I've shot well, you know, I'm just missing some putts and stuff. And so I think it's important to keep yourself, actually, in my first-person shooter book, the reason why I said it was so important to stay positive in this sense is because it makes you more susceptible in the day and into the zone. You don't get into the zone when you're really mad at yourself and you're flustered. You get into the zone when you're feeling positive and you're just focused on what you have control over.
Right, and if you're mad and flustered and you don't get into the zone, then you're going to end up doing worse as you continue to play, which gets you even more frustrated, so you can't get in the zone even more, and it just continues.
Yeah, and another thing I want to say, you kind of talked about humility being important. I actually read a book that was by a sports psychologist who wrote 100 things that, like, the best athletes do that the others don't. And the first thing he said is that the best athletes are more objective than their counterparts. They, when they lose, they say, why did I lose? Why exactly did I lose? And then they figure out objectively how to fix that problem. And the people with too big of egos, not that good athletes don't have egos, they are very smart in their training, but they have big egos elsewhere. But most people, you know, they let their ego get in the way. They just say, like, they make up excuses. They say, like, this stopped me from doing well, this or that. You know, I'm not naturally good enough. Or they, you know, they kind of attack themselves. Like, I'm just not naturally good enough to be good at this. And,
yeah.
But the good player looks at it objectively, more objectively than other people, and says, if I put in this amount of practice, then I will get these results and I will improve this area and that. And I think the same is true under pressure. They look at it objectively. What do I have to do to win? Not how is my mind going to mess me up or help
right.
me?
Right. One thing I wanted to do is just talk briefly about the science part of getting better at a certain skill, and talk specifically about genes and that whole debate between nurture versus nature. Yeah, because everyone's thinking, well, if I don't have the genes, if I'm not tall enough in basketball, then, I mean, I might as well not even try. And that's just one thing I wanted to express is, while genes may have somewhat of an impact, it really, I believe at least, it's more about what you do starting from a very young age. So just to get into some science, each gene, there's many genes in the body, but all of them can either be turned on or not turned off.
And this is called epigenetics, right?
Yeah, this is called epigenetics. But the whole point is that you could have, like, the best gene in the world, but if you never, for, let's say, playing basketball, you have just an amazing coordination genes, but if you never turn them on, then they would just slowly degrade with time, and they would be completely worthless to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what guides evolution, but that's a completely different topic. But
yeah,
the whole thing is that what the mechanism that turns them on or off is called the epigenome. And what that refers to are different, what we call methylation patterns, or different little attachments that go on your DNA. So DNA is made of like four different letters.
Yeah.
And a lot of DNA basically composes a gene. But if you decorate or you put these little attachment, these methyl groups on, it signals that gene to be activated. So the question becomes, well, what puts methyl groups on your gene in order for it to be activated? And the answer is practicing that skill. When you play basketball, when you play violin, the genes necessary to make that happen get more methylation patterns on them.
Wow, yeah.
It changes the methylation patterns on them so that they can be activated more.
Mm-hmm.
And so the result of those genes makes your cells more attuned to being able to master those skills. So the ability to do this increases when you're younger. The younger you start, this is why the younger you start, the better you are at something.
Mm-hmm.
If your brain is more plastic, which means it can form those neuron connections that we talked about earlier more easily, and you can activate different genes more easily as well for your muscle cells, neuron cells, etc. So the whole point is that there is a lot of potential in you. If you've never been like a good athlete or something like that, you actually may be. You just haven't turned on the genes to do so. And mm-hmm. with enough practice, you would actually be able to turn those genes on. So don't give up. Just because you're short, or just because you think you might be not very skilled to do something, with enough practice, you will be able to at least surpass even the average player.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. And also, for people who are older and they find that discouraging, that the brain's more plastic when you're young, remember that there's people like Michael Jordan, who's arguably the best basketball player ever, who didn't pick up a basketball until he was like an adolescent.
Yeah.
So you can still, you know, get over those humps when you're older and still change those genetics for your favor.
Right. Michael Jordan might have had the genes all along. He just never activated them
mm-hmm.
to begin with.
Well, he definitely had some genetic advantage, like his ability to chomp and things like that.
Right.
So just to clarify more, so like let's say that you have a genetic tendency towards lung cancer and it's in your genealogy. Does that mean that you should just, you know, give up on everything and just assume that you're eventually going to die of lung cancer, smoke anyway because you know you're going to get it? Or does that mean that if you exercise, you can deactivate or activate other genes that prevent lung cancer?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And the answer truly is there is a lot you can do.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you have a high risk of lung cancer, yes, your genes may be altered so that you have an increased risk. But you can severely decrease that risk by eating healthy, not smoking, mm-hmm. exercising regularly, doing all the healthy things that doctors recommend, because those alter your methylation patterns on your genes, and they change the protein content in your cells and just the chances of your cells mutating into a cancer as well.
Mm-hmm.
So saying don't get tans all the time, because the tans will introduce different electromagnetic radiation waves that induce a mutation.
Yes.
Yeah. And the more mutations you get, the more higher of a chance that you'll get lung cancer.
Right, yeah.
So, or any type of cancer for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
So just to clarify for people, you know, even if you have a high susceptibility of the disease, that just means you should have more of a reason to prevent it, to take all the measures you possibly can to prevent it. It's not the other way around. It's not like, well, I have a high chance, I might as well just give up and just fall for that disease. No, the answer is do the most you can to fight getting that disease.
And it's, you have a high chance of preventing it, or delaying it at least.
Yeah, even if you have an increased risk for lung cancer, there are so many things you can do. Even diet alone will decrease your risk substantially compared to the average person who has, you know, the average person who might get lung cancer.
So another quick question I have is, can your diet improve your ability to learn a skill? When you're talking about epigenetics, you're saying that your diet can have an influence on on the cellular level. Are you saying that it can also increase your ability to learn a skill?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it depends. You would probably want to modify your diet depending on the skill that you're trying to learn.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, if you eat lots of fruits and vegetables and absorb the micronutrients and different vitamins from them, you will be able to increase your neuron abilities, your muscular abilities, your endurance abilities, your coordination abilities, your reflex abilities.
Wow.
It just goes on and on. You won't get sick as much, which means you have more days of practice. It just goes on and on and on. It's ridiculous how long the list is.
If only people could exercise.
Right, yeah, but I mean, the point is you can even start small steps, even diet. If you just make small changes in your diet, the results are dramatic. It's almost as if it's like going from 4 hours of sleep a night to 8 hours of sleep a night. You just can't appreciate it because you don't have the exact pain receptors for a bad diet.
Yeah.
With sleep, you do. So that's why you feel the need for sleeping, you know.
Wow, yeah. So if you're not already convinced, start eating a good diet.
Yes.
It'll make your life a lot better in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and also there's a lot of, even for non-physical skills, like maybe say, you know, chess.
Chess,
but even those experts, they have this like crazy workout routine, because they know that from endurance running or from like eating a good diet, they will be able to mentally concentrate better than if they were to just sit on the couch.
Yeah, you know, and I actually have some perspective on this. Recently I took up playing chess, And I took myself from probably about like an 800 level to around 15 to 1600. And it was a pretty short period of time. And I think a lot of my improvements can be related back to sort of my resume, my practice resume. I mean, I'm obviously pretty nerdy if I'm practicing chess, but like one recommendation that Grandmaster had that really helped my game a lot was to do practice problems. Like in chess, you have like checkmate puzzles and things, which require a lot of calculating. Like you have to say, like, if I move here, then my opponent can move here, here, and here. So how can I checkmate this opponent in four moves? And they require a lot of brain power. And what the Grandmaster recommended was doing these puzzles when you're tired, because playing chess is far less about intelligence than it is about mental endurance. And you can improve how far you can calculate. When I started, I was terrible at calculating. Like, I played Jonathan Hilton, who's a national master in chess, and we played checkers, and he just kept beating me because he kept seeing further than I did. But then I started training and stuff, and now I can see just as far as him, and now we have very competitive games.
Right, and what you're saying is that, just to clarify, when you say further, you mean anticipating more moves. So, like, six moves from now, this is what the board is going to look like.
Yeah, so, like, in checkers, for example, every move is called one ply. So a ply is a half move, because one player moved and another player moved.
Right.
So I probably took mine from about, like, two or three ply to, like, seven or eight ply.
Which is ridiculous when you try this, because it gets harder harder each ply that you go.
Because you have to remember where your pieces are on the board, which pieces moved, and then you have to remember which pieces could move and influence the position.
Right.
And so the further you go, the harder it gets. Obviously, this is why computers are so good at checkers and chess, is because computers can see, you know, 20 ply. They can see far deeper than people can. But a grandmaster who's trained a long time can beat a computer because of intuition, and it's not necessary to see that far ply to be good. There's a lot more theory involved.
And by the way, most people will be like, okay, well, that's just chess and checkers. That's kind of like a worthless skill to train.
Oh, yeah.
But this skill, this very skill of predicting so far in advance, is actually found throughout a lot of other different skill sets.
Yeah. Especially math in school. A lot of people get a challenging math problem and they give up. But what chess has taught me is that you have to just keep looking at it and keep seeing all the different pieces of it. And having that skill set from chess carries over to math tremendously.
Yeah, I think also another thing is the mind-blowing spy movies or a plot twist where all along this guy was this mastermind between, and he predicts all these things that were going to happen. And then you're just blown away. You're like, oh my gosh, I could have never done that. But that's what this skill is.
Yeah.
It's the very skill of predicting, okay, if you do that, then I'll do this, then you do that, then I'll do this to counter that, then you'll do that. And it's the amount, your foresight ability to calculate and keep things in check. I think that is
one of the most valuable life tools. I mean, like, if you're a CEO of a company, you're constantly doing that with
other companies. They raise their product price, which means more consumers will buy our price, but that means they might increase the quality of their product price, which means our marketing needs to go up more. I think if you can take this plan and write it, it's easier if you write it down, but you can see how far things are going to progress. It's almost like you're trying to predict the future, what's going to happen if you make a decision. And then based upon all these different prediction paths, you make the best decision.
Yeah.
So,
and I think as people, we often forget that everything happens in logical sequence in the world. Like, this decision causes this, then that causes this, then that causes this. And all of these steps are necessary to reach an end outcome. Oftentimes we think, like, oh, like, you know, these really smart people just look at the problem and they solve it. No, this really smart person takes the problem and breaks it into small steps one at a time and sees up until the end.
Yeah. One thing, I've just kind of had this motto going for me for a long time is, nothing is actually complicated. Mm-hmm. Everything that appears to be complicated is just a series of many simple steps all amassed into one jump. Like when you're in a math problem and you see this fraction, this huge fraction, and it gets reduced down to like two variables, you're like, what? How did they do that? But in reality, all they did is like 10 steps and just combined it into one.
Yeah.
And you could have done each of those 10 steps. You could have crossed out.
They were all simple steps.
They were all very simple.
They're just like addition, subtraction, multiplication.
Division, yeah. And then you get to the end, you're like, oh, actually, well, it took me more time to do it.
Yeah.
But I was able to reach the same result.
Yeah. And, you know, like, when I... Sometimes I'll pick up a book and I'll start reading it. I'll be like, holy crap, I don't understand anything that's being said. But one of the things I've learned through experience is that it's not... I'm not understanding because I'm not intelligent enough. It's that I don't have the background buildup of knowledge to understand it. Like, you can't pick up a quantum mechanics book if you don't know mechanical
physics. Yeah.
And so you have to start progressively. Once you've read the mechanical physics book, then the quantum mechanics book makes complete sense. You see it a lot in like the education system.
Right.
You know, everyone in your elementary school teachers tell you like calculus is gonna be so hard, but by the time you get to calculus, it's not hard because you know all of the stuff that you need to know to learn that next step.
Right. So if you don't know algebra and you're trying to do calculus, it's nearly impossible.
Yeah.
But if you know algebra, you know, pretty thoroughly, calculus is just a simple next step.
Yeah. It's a simple next step.
It's like going from addition to multiplication.
Right. And that's why when you listen to like a keynote speaker who's maybe a quantum or theoretical physicist, you know, who talks about all these like ridiculous numbers, you can't say to yourself, like, I'm not smart enough to understand this. The reason why they understand it is because often what we forget is that they got their doctorate, which meant that they spent hours of this stuff building up this this like repertoire of knowledge over a long period of time to reach where they're at. And you can do it too, as long as you take those next steps to reach that place.
Yeah, they've probably spent at least 10,000 hours on it too.
Yeah, definitely. At least 10,000 hours. Yeah. Einstein, I mean, he's recognized as one of the most intelligent people ever. Einstein probably spent more time than like anyone else has on the theory of relativity.
Relatively. Just kidding, yeah.
Like Stephen Hawking. Like, Hawking is actually a really fascinating character because he's always been really smart because he actually came from a family of very intelligent people. Like, his family was known as, like, the intellectual family. When they ate dinner with other families, the Hawking's family was known to read books instead of talking to the other people at the dinner table while they're eating dinner.
Right. Yeah. Well, actually, that's an interesting topic because a lot of things that we talk about today in today's economy, at least, are like the brain drain and how different intelligence jobs are going to like India and China because they are just simply quote unquote smarter. But the thing is that if you look at the culture there, from day one, you are studying like constantly. Right. There's no time to, you don't socialize as much because it's not valued. In that culture, it doesn't matter if you're the best joke teller or you can... even sports, I would say, is not as prominent there.
Yeah.
But what's important there is how far are you up the intelligence ladder and what career position has that put you in?
Yeah, and an important thing to point out, too, is that often the United States is criticized for our educational system. Our educational system is actually probably the best in the world, but the reason why it's not ranked the best in the world is because we educate everybody. When you look at other countries, they like select who they're going to educate. Yeah. We educate everybody. So when you look at person for person, socioeconomic status for socioeconomic status, and you compare the education that they get, it's pretty comparable, if not better, in the United States. I don't want to say that's true because it really just depends on where you're at. But if you compare an institution like MIT to the best college elsewhere, MIT is often going to win. But yes, what you're saying often is true of like, you know, Chinese Americans. They value their education more. And that's a very interesting debate on whether that is a good thing to value more.
Right. Well, one thing I wanted to say, you know, while you may be getting more EQ, more intellectual intelligence, you may be sacrificing your emotional intelligence.
Well, of course you are. And that's the thing that people need to remember is that we're not all that. Most of us are cut from similar cloths. Like, obviously, there's advantages that people have genetically. But at the end of the day, it comes down to how much work you put into something. And when you put work into one thing, it means you put less work into another thing.
Yeah, because you can only do one thing at a time.
Yeah. And so someone who's really smart is going to be lacking socially, almost like most of the time.
Right. And someone who's actually super social may lack certain smarts that most people have.
So, yeah, and so at the end of the day, most of what it comes down to is practice and hard work.
Yeah, but I think at the same time, though, at least in today's society, I think the balance of them is very critical to have.
Oh, yeah.
If you look at the best CEOs, they are both intelligent, but they're also both socially intelligent. They're both emotionally intelligent. And it's very hard, in my opinion, to master two skills because that means you have to give up one at
entire mastery of
entire mastery of to master the other, and you have to keep them both in check. It's relatively easy to master one skill because that's your goal. You're just focusing on one skill. I'm going to just get through medical school, and that's it. That's my one skill, my one goal. But if you want to both master emotional intelligence and intellectual intelligence, at that point, you have to divide yourself between these two. And I think that itself is very difficult to do that
and
mentally.
I think doing it simultaneously is nearly impossible. I think that what you're identifying is actually why you see high school nerds going on to become CEOs.
Yeah,
people who are losers in high school are often losers because they didn't spend all their time socializing. They spend their time doing other stuff. You know, I don't want to say
building a supercomputer in the backyard.
And so, but what's going on here is that they're building that intelligence first, and they're lacking that EQ. But then, when they realize how important EQ is, they use that intelligence they built to then help them with EQ
social.
And so, a lot of times, this is actually a very important part of learning a skill. And I'm glad we brought it up. Is set like breaking stuff down into separate challenges or topics. Like when you were like working on just left hand, working on right, like free throw shots, breaking it down to simple stuff because you can't do simultaneously practice a lot of things at a time.
Right.
It's better to focus on one at one time and then focus on another. And that's what you'll see with high school kids. They focus really hard on the intellectual stuff, the nerds do, and then they focus really hard on the EQ stuff.
Right.
And that's why they develop the EQ fast. And I actually think that it is actually superior to develop the intellectual side first because you can use those traits to help with EQ. Now, the disadvantage, of course, is that
it's kind
of critical period.
Well, right, yeah.
Well, you lose the critical period of, like, young age.
Young age, yeah.
I don't know about fake because
I
think...
Yeah, I mean, I think... Well, here's the thing. Let's compare... Let's just take social intelligence or emotional intelligence, EQ. You know, if you just naturally learned it, you know, you naturally learn that when someone crosses their arms, that means they're not enjoying it. Or when they're, like, kind of sitting off to the side or they're not smiling as much. you would just learn that subconsciously.
You don't see it and say it to yourself while they're bored. You just notice their...
Now, but pretend you just spent your whole life in the books, and now you're going to college finally, and you have you're just not adept in this area. You would probably, as an intellectual person, break it down move by move. It's like, okay, they cross their arms, -5 points. Oh, wait, but that's right. Now they're smiling a little bit, so +2. You know, and you're just... Like,
it's incredibly logical versus emotional.
Right.
And that's the problem. And yeah, and that's exactly a problem that the intellectuals have. It's a problem that I have all the time. It's like, I'm too analytical. I break stuff down too much. And, you know, someone who's just good just naturally does what's right. But I do think that the logical part is the beginning of... It's just a beginning phase. Like, when that's happening is when it's not down. It's not concrete.
It's the bottom of the J curve?
It's the bottom. Like, you're still starting. Like, you're... Like, let's say you're working on, like, telling better stories or something. When you first tell those stories, they're going to be really overly logical.
Yeah, for, like, a comedy routine.
Yeah, and, like, yeah, if you're doing stand-up, they're going to sound weird. They're not going to be very fluid and stuff. But through practice, you become fluid. And that's why you see stand-up comedians who look like they're just coming up with the stuff on the spot.
Right. Because, it's been practiced, and the errors have been ironed out. And they've gone through the J-curve for each of those stories.
Yeah.
And the different body language, tone of voice, delivery mechanisms all incorporated into one.
Yeah.
Delivery.
Right. And actually, the whole logical thing with social stuff is a very interesting thing, because being logical in a social situation is often bad, because people tend to go off of each other's vibes, energy, emotional energy. Like, someone's excited, everyone else gets excited. The person who sits there and is like, he's excited, what should I do? What should I do? Like, in their head, doesn't act upon their emotional
I think, self. Yeah, I think also it kind of distracts you from the conversation. If you're constantly calculating everybody's score of emotional status, that means you have to both calculate it and be like, okay, based upon our findings, we now have to go into this emotional zone.
Yeah.
And it's just so hard to, it's constantly changing, you know, you have to, it's like you're constantly firing. It's like a, and so I feel like it's really, really hard. And that's why your subconscious, you know, just science really quick, your subconscious part of your brain is much, much more powerful than your actual conscious part of your brain. Your subconscious makes you conscious.
Yeah.
But there's far, it's like an iceberg. There's far more subconscious than you're aware of. And you couldn't be aware of it because it's the subconscious that's making you aware of it in the first place. Mm-hmm. So the whole point is that if you could subconsciously, just like you can subconsciously walk or subconsciously breathe, if you can subconsciously evaluate other people's emotional status,
it's superior.
Your conscious part of your brain is free. You can now think about another thing. You can think about your next joke you're going to say. But if you're developing this mechanism where you're constantly calculating everybody's moves consciously, then you're filled. There's no more conscious room for you to develop the next joke, the next punchline.
Right, yeah. And that's a great point with mastery, because it really goes into that. What I think about the whole logical thing is that it is like sort of the beginning of learning a new skill, and the neurons haven't built to click so that you can do it subconsciously effectively. So I think when you start out with something, you start out very logical, and then through repetition you get to the point where you can do it subconsciously. That's what you see, like, you know, like when you dribble a basketball left hand the first time, you think about it very logically, like, what am I doing? Until the point where you can just do it subconsciously. I think the same happens.
Right.
I actually have a really good analogy for what we're kind of describing here. So have you ever, like, had to walk but thought about how you're walking? So, like, you're maybe someone, like, who's around you who's intimidating, like your boss or something, like, you have to walk in a line in front of them, but you're thinking about how you're walking while you're doing it. You can't walk. You look like an idiot. Like, or
you end up tripping.
You end up doing something weird. And that's what causes people to, like, you know, act like goofy and stuff, is they try to think about it while they do it. And that's the same thing that happens socially. When you're thinking about how to be social,
such as on a first date.
Yeah. You can't do it. You can't do it well.
Right.
And because
everything is over dramatized. Like, your laugh is too long. It's too hot. It's too hot. Like, harder. It's too high.
Yeah.
And, or your body language is too extravagant. It's too excessive.
Yeah, and that's why I think, in the end, that's why experience and practice are incredibly important for social things. So you need to get repetitions with people. You know, it sounds kind of weird, but you need to be around people practicing these things, but at the same time, being okay with looking like an idiot, because the only way you can get to that point is to look like an idiot sometimes.
Right, yeah, and that's the
humility factor. I look like all the time. So.
One thing we should just comment on really quick is practicing a skill to maintain it. So, for example, if you speak a language, and you speak it all, maybe 20 years you speak Spanish, your first 20 years of your life, but then you stop speaking it, and then you try speaking it again 10 years from now, you'll realize that you're much worse than when you left off 10 years ago. And a lot of people wonder, like, why that is. And this applies to any skill, basketball, golf. There's a reason why everybody maintains and practices the same drills, even if they're very good at it. It's because they're trying to retain the muscle memory and also the way your neurons are wired in your brain to mentally think about a task.
Yeah.
So
you're kind of saying, like, fundamentals are always really important.
Right. Fundamentals are important, but just practicing that skill. So, for example, like, if a computer learns something, it's learned it, period. Mm-hmm. It never has to practice it ever again, and it can just do it the same, you know, ability-wise when it needs to do it again, like a robotic arm, for example. Mm-hmm. But with humans, that's not the case.
Is it because of, like, something like homeostasis? And, you know, like, because, like, let's say you, like, put on, like, muscle mass, and then you stop using that muscle mass. Your body's like, I need to conserve energy, and this muscle's doing nothing for me. Let's burn it off.
Well, it's simply put, it's just if you don't use it, lose it. So if you were into like running, for example, and then all of a sudden, like one day you just quit, like you used to run 10 miles a day and you just quit.
Yeah.
When you try to run 2 years later, you'll probably be able to run like maybe 3 miles, a little bit more than the average person because of that past history.
Yeah.
But the whole point is that the muscles and energy that your body was expending into this is no longer necessary. So your body doesn't create anymore. Mm-hmm. But people are like, okay, well, then you can kind of retrain yourself.
Right. And that is actually really important because it can be really humiliating. Like when you lift a lot, put on a lot of weight and it goes away. Yeah. The great thing is you lift 2 weeks and you get back what took 8 weeks before to go.
Right. But that is not as encouraged as much that like, oh, off and then on and off and then on, especially with exercise. But what I'm trying to say more importantly is that, yes, you can notice this physically, but this also happens mentally. Mm-hmm. So if you speak a different language, or for example, if you used to do like even piano or math, another skill, the thing is that your brain had a certain set of neurons dedicated to this. And if you never use it, your brain starts to use those neurons for other things. It changes how they're oriented, and they use those neurons for another thing that you happen to be doing. So if you happen to just, one day you've been practicing piano like all the time, like hourly every day or something because you loved it, and then all of a sudden for, you know, 2, 3, 4 years, you just drop it and you just start watching TV. The neurons that were dedicated to all those hours of piano are just transferred into watching TV and learning whether the latest couple broke up or the new drama situation or something like that. So the whole point is that if you get and master a skill, it's just, even if you've reached your 10,000 hours, the whole point is that you have to maintain it in order for you to still have that same mastery level of a skill.
Yeah. And you know, it can be discouraging at times. You work really hard for something and then you lose it. But our life is short, for one. Yeah. And you know, if you work 10 years for something, you take 2 years off, and you pick up again, you're probably gonna get back to where you are faster than what it took you to get there in the first place. But a lot of the skill sets we have are not used throughout our whole life. You know, things change. We do different stuff. You know, we don't keep playing basketball our whole life. Like,
And a lot of people are like, they always think like, man, that's terrible. Like, so my body will, like, my skill level will degenerate if I don't use it. Why wouldn't we just retain those neurons in order for us to just use in case we ever have to in the future? And it's all about conservation. Because the thing is that if you actually saved those neurons to do piano, then you wouldn't have any neurons left to learn a new skill.
Yeah.
If you didn't get rid of your old memories, you would have no memory to make memories for new ones. And your more recent memories are more important than your past memories.
Right. So, now, just a quick question, kind of on the topic of memories. What I've heard, though, is that all of your memories are stored forever in your brain. Not forever, but throughout your life. It's just that our ability to bring them up is limited. Like what you'll see is like experiences where someone hallucinates and they're able to bring up images from their past that were long forgotten.
Right. Well, that might be true, but the thing is that you physically cannot store everything that you have experienced before. Mm-hmm. Not to make a comparison to computers, but you may store a compressed version of it,
okay,
like in a zip folder. Yeah. So, for example, like when you recall a memory, you may not recall what was on the sign in the background, but you recall that there's a sign.
Mm-hmm.
Or you may recall that there was like 5 people there and you know 4 of them, but you don't know the 5th person because that person wasn't really involved in the conversation.
Yeah.
But if you traveled back more recently, you would realize, oh, actually, I know that person. I know all five people.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing too I want to say is that if every time you recall a memory, you strengthen the connection to access that memory.
Yeah.
So
that's important with learning too, is like, let's say you learned a language 10 years ago and you're picking it up again.
Yeah.
That you're like rewiring those.
Yeah, it's much easier to learn it if you've already learned it in the past.
Yeah, and teaching, that's why teaching is really useful. That's why teaching like cements what you've learned, is because you take something that you already know how to do and you teach it to someone else and it actually builds up the wiring.
Right.
So you can do it even better.
Exactly. So unfortunately, that's all the time that we have today for our podcast. But
yeah.
Thanks again. Stay tuned.
Real quick, just a quick rundown of all the tips. Like, remember, sit through those plateaus when you get them. Practice 3 hours a day if you really want to hit mastery.
Or even a consistent level.
Just a consistent level.
Even a half an hour a day.
Remember,
is good.
28-mile march.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Right. And yeah, a couple other things that, you know, with time, you may lose your skill set if you don't practice it. So try, even if you do 15 minutes a week, something to retain it. The more you do, the better. But, and finally, you know, with the genes and nature versus nurture, there's a lot you can do to improve your abilities as skill,
mm-hmm.
even if your genes aren't as good as somebody else's. So
yeah.
It's definitely a reason to keep practicing and keep building skills.
All right. Adios, guys.
Thanks, guys.